You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Yo, what is going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show Me the Meaning!
I am Austin Hayden, and I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We have Raymond.
Hey, everybody, how's it going?
And we've got Michael back with us.
Hey, what's up? Two in a row. Apologies, everyone.
And this week we're going to be talking about the 2011, I guess we can call it a cult classic, right? Attack the Block. There's been a recent announcement that finally, after 10 years, the sequel that has been long awaited is in development, apparently. It will be helmed by Joe Cornish, the original writer and director, and it will star the original star that launched this star's career into the fucking stratosphere. That's called alliteration, friends. John Boyega, who you all know from Star Wars and Disney fame now. And yeah, this is kind of the film that put him on the map when he was a young actor in London. And so they're going to be doing a sequel. So we were like, well, shoot, why don't we jump into the original? It is a great film filled with all kinds of rich themes, and I'm sure we'll peel some of those things back. But it's also just a really cool, slick sci-fi and a great directorial debut from Joe Cornish as well. So we can talk about all those things. So we'll get there. It also has Jodie Whittaker in it, and Nick Frost makes an appearance, which I totally forgot that he was in this film. And a bunch of kind of unknown, non-professional actors playing the rest of the teenage gang that is helmed
by cast all around.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll get into that. But before we do first impressions, I do want to kick it over to Michael, because Michael has a little announcement about some other Wisecrack stuff that we got to plug here. So, Michael,
is huge, huge news, everyone. If you like this podcast, there's a chance that you also watch a show called Rick and Morty. There's also a chance that you previously listened to the Wisecrack podcast, The Squanch, where we break down every episode of Rick and Morty. And want to let everyone know, The Squanch is back. We actually already recorded a preview episode with me, Ryan Haley, that you definitely know if you watch this, and Tommy Cook. So you can check that out right now. It's on all the streaming platforms and YouTube. And we will be starting the season this Sunday, June 20th. And right after the first episode of Rick and Morty airs on East Coast time, we're going to go live. So we'll be there. We got it's going to be me, Ryan Haley, and a rotating cast of geniuses this season. But it'll be fun.
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds actually more than good. I'm actually looking forward to it. Yeah. All right. Okay. So you know the deal. This is how we basically start off every episode. We go around. We get first impressions. Now, Michael and I were just talking off air, and we were like, oh, shoot. All we really remembered was that we enjoyed this film, but we don't really remember what we enjoyed about this film. So let's talk about first impressions. What was it like the first time we saw it, if we can remember it, even if it's just some sort of sense impression? And then what was it like revisiting this film? And let's start with Michael. Michael, so what was it like the first time that you watched Attack the Block?
You know, sometimes like you could go to a restaurant or something like that and you enjoy it. And then 5 years later, you're like, I'll go back there. But if I were to say, like, what dish did you like? What did it taste like? You would have nothing. But you would say, I just remember that I liked it. Sadly, yeah. That's me in this movie. I think I saw it in theaters. I saw it at a time where, like Austin, I was living in the United Kingdom, which always adds a little bit of extra flavor when you're watching a sort of lower budget UK film four thing. I remember liking it a lot. I remember thinking that Boyega ripped. Obviously, watching other British shows, I was a big fan of Nick Frost and Jodie Whittaker. But I remembered liking it, not a lot else. Going back into it, I was surprised that I still liked it a lot. And I think I appreciated a lot of what the film was trying to say in ways that I'm not sure that I would have in 2011. And I think I found the context of the movie a lot more interesting. And I was even thinking about it in comparison to like Get Out and some other films that kind of explore ideas of race along with horror and sci-fi elements. But liked it a lot, made me more excited that a new one's coming out. And I definitely all in on this movie. If you haven't seen it, you should watch it. Not sure what we're all going to think, not sure what we'll discuss exactly, but enjoyed it. Would go back to the restaurant.
All right, Raymond, what about you?
I really love this movie. Maybe similar to Michael, I probably had a better recollection of the first time that I saw it. I really enjoyed it the first time around, but it wasn't until I watched it a second time a few years after that I remember thinking, like, no, this is a great fucking movie. It's so sharp, so well written. It moves like a freight train. And when I was watching it again this morning, I've seen it, you know, two or three times since the first time I've watched it. And so I thought, I'll put on one of the... There are three commentaries on this Blu-ray. It's totally stacked. I would check it out if you're a big fan of this movie. But I put on one of the commentaries. It's a really great conversation between Joe Cornish and Edgar Wright. And I was thinking to myself, I know this movie well enough. I could probably do a podcast about it without rewatching it. So let me just listen to what they have to say. And I was kind of stricken in a weird way that, like, with the soundtrack for the movie dipped down so they could do the commentary track, I was kind of amazed as I was watching it, because it is the rare contemporary film that this is I think something of a metric of success with a screenplay is that you can tell exactly what is happening in this movie, who these characters are, what they want, what they're trying to accomplish, what the relationship dynamics are to each other. Like, you can turn the volume down and you get absolutely everything about this. It's not only great snappy dialogue, but it doesn't even need that. It's such great visual storytelling. You know who these kids are from the moment they show up and they look like trouble, and then throughout the rest of the movie, as you know, the hoods and the bandanas and all the layers, that as all that stuff starts to come off, and you realize, like, these are just kids, you know, like they're just out there getting into trouble, making mistakes. And just as I was thinking that, they say on the commentary that one of the things Joe Cornish mentioned was that he thinks, or maybe it was Edgar Wright brought this up, that if these kids were 18 years old, if they were all only 2 or 3 years older, the movie wouldn't work at all. You'd hate them because they would bear such a greater burden of responsibility for their actions at the beginning of the film. But they just thread this needle so beautifully in this film. It's so well cast. It's so well written. And very, very wonderfully staged. I give it 2 thumbs up. I think it's phenomenal.
Yeah, there's the one scene where Moses, where Samantha's going through Moses' apartment, and she's like, you know, who lives here? And uncle comes and goes, blah, blah, blah. And then she's like, how old are you? And he's like, 15. And you're like, oh, shit, okay. And he's probably the oldest of the gang, right? Or at least he's the most mature. There might be one or two of the others that are, but like Pest looks like he's like 13. You know?
Yeah. And that moment's so cool, because when you know, she says he's 15 and she's like, you look older. And he's like, thank you. In this way, yeah, where he's like, yeah, I want to be old. I want to be whatever. Right. But she says it with this tone of like, oh, shit, like, you're a kid. Like, yeah, I've been looking at you as, you know, because there's a scene early on, I shouldn't get too much ahead of it, where Jodie Whittaker and her neighbor call the kids like fucking monsters. And we have early in the film Whittaker agreeing with that. At the end, her just being like, man, you're just a kid. And that reversal of the way in which she perceives them. Oh, God. But I'm getting ahead of it. Sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. So my first impression, again, I actually, very similar to Michael, I didn't really remember. I just remember this is one of those films that over the years when people are like, when it comes up or when they mention John Boyega, I'm like, oh, did you ever see Attack the Block? I'm like, you got to see Attack the Block. But I couldn't ever explain why. And they'd be like, why? And I was like, oh, it's, you know, it's like it takes place in South London, and it's like these like hoodlum kids, and they save the neighborhood from aliens. And they're like, okay. And I'm like, no. But I'm like, it's so much more than that. And it's really good. And it's really fast and it's fresh and all this stuff. So for me, it was always something that it left an indelible mark, but I couldn't exactly describe what it was, at least at the level of content. And I actually think that's okay, because revisiting this film, like, yes, there's social commentary and there's things like that that I'm sure we're going to delve into. After all, the title of this podcast is Show Me the Meaning, not Let's Just Talk About Whether or Not We Like This Film. So I'm sure we'll get into that.
That'd be a cool title, too.
But one... but the thing that struck
whether or
me
not
more than
we
anything,
like this film,
the thing that struck me more than anything was the energy of this film. This film just has an energy. It gets in, it gets out. There is zero exposition about the aliens and their intention. I mean, there's the one bit about the moth, I guess, that you get at the end with the one guy, the stoner dude that's sitting there watching the science show. But even that, it's not really exposition about who the aliens are and what they're doing. I mean, there's a little bit of speculation, I guess, but they don't know. There isn't like government officials like, we're under siege, you know, lock yourselves down, citizens. We have a plan. We're coming to the... There's none of that. It's literally just like this small, intimate, immersive story about what would happen in this area if some shit went down. And you just get these teenagers who are at first deemed to be the monsters, but then who encounter real monsters who then become the heroes, right? And so it's just this really kind of... I read this one little review, and I won't say too much about it. We can talk about it on the other side of the synopsis, where it was more like a think piece, where they were saying that what Joe Cornish does is he just totally saturates us in the world, in a world that is unfamiliar probably to not only international audiences, but probably even to British audiences. The slang, the language, and there's no explanation of what those terms mean. They just are used over and over and over and over and over again. And by the end, you're like, oh, okay, I get it now. It's like Rosetta Stone, the language program that just kind of is immersive, that just throws you into it, but it doesn't like translate it for you. And it's like traveling through a foreign world. And that I really love about it. You're just thrown into this city or into this block within this suburb, within this part of the city. And it's doesn't have any sort of like meta commentary outside of it. So all the social commentary that we're deriving from it is something that is just experientially derived from these people. So yeah, what were you going to say, Raymond?
Oh, I was just going to say on that note, Joe Cornish on the behind the scenes feature on the Blu-ray, he's talking to one of the kids. I think the kid that plays Probs, and the kid asks him, "Where'd you get the idea for this movie?" And Joe Cornish says, have you seen the movie Signs with Mel Gibson and all the aliens and stuff? And the kid goes, yeah. He goes, well, I saw that movie. I really liked it, but I wanted to see what would happen if that movie happened to a housing block where I live instead of out in a cornfield in the middle of nowhere. And he's going on and on, and he says, and the thing that really got to me about that, the thing that really excited me about the idea, and this was sort of what sparked this recollection for me, Austin, that you sort of alluded to the fact that these are not the kids you anticipate to be the heroes of a movie like this. And he said, you know, I really liked the idea that all these kids that people look down on or people are afraid of, or that they don't take the time to try and understand, if something really bad like this happened, they'd be the first ones on the front lines, because they're, you know, they are the first people in like the classic 80s movie fashion. The kids are always the one to understand the premise of the movie before anybody else, and they're the ones with the like the vim and vigor to go do something about it. So, I like this movie a lot.
All right, so the last thing that I'll say, and then we'll just do a quick little recap of the film, is I also heard that Joe Cornish was himself mugged in South London by a group of teens. And so it was this film kind of fell out of his imagination once he said he started to realize that these teens had a much richer inner life and social life than they're typically given credit for in the act of just being mugged. And he was like, okay. So I think there's something really interesting, and I guess there's an act of empathy there that maybe kind of explains why this film is so immersive and gives us just a tour through a foreign land. So anyway, I love this film. And I'm glad that I loved it, because I hate when you revisit a film and you loved it and you're like, oh man, I didn't love it. And then you've ruined the great viewing experience that you had the first time around. But so I love it. Okay, here we go. We'll do a quick recap and then we'll start peeling things back. So it's Guy Fawkes night, and trainee nurse Samantha Adams is mugged by a gang of teens in South London. When something falls from the sky and crushes a nearby car, Samantha escapes. The leader of this little gang, Moses, checks out the crash site, hoping to find some valuables in the car, but an unfamiliar creature begins to attack him, scratch his face, and then runs away. The teens end up tracking the creature down and killing it. They take it to local drug dealer Hi-Hats in hopes that they can find a way to make some money and maybe some fame from killing this thing, selling it, whatever. And soon they learn that this creature is actually an alien, and then more and more objects begin falling from the sky, and they start to realize that it's a type of invasion. So the gang load up on some weapons and go to try to take more of these aliens out, but these new ones are much bigger and scarier, so it's going to take a lot more than just beating it with a bat. Meanwhile, Samantha accompanies the police so that she can identify the muggers. They end up finding Moses and the gang, and Moses gets arrested, but while he's in the police van, an alien attacks the cops, which then lets Dennis, one of the other gang members, drive the van to safety, so with Samantha still in the van, but Samantha ends up fleeing, and the rest of the gang try to get to Wyndham Tower, and then Pest, one of the other gang members, he ends up getting bitten, and then they find out that Samantha lives in their building. But because they know that she's a nurse trainee, they get her to treat his injured leg, and then Samantha ends up deciding to join them to take down the aliens. Now later they learn that the aliens are somehow attracted to Moses because of a little mark that has been placed on his jacket, and that they're going to keep coming after him and the gang, so they decide to form a plan to stop the aliens once and for all. Moses lures all the aliens into one apartment that's filled with gas, lights off some fireworks, and causes a massive explosion while he leaps to safety out of a window. Explosion kills all the aliens and leaves a huge portion of the building in flames. Afterwards, the cops come and arrest Moses and the surviving members of the gang, assuming them to be responsible for the deaths in the neighborhood and the damage caused. Samantha corrects the story, but they're still arrested, and they're thrown into the back of a police van where they can hear the residents of the block cheering for Moses. All right, before we continue, I got to give a shout out to our sponsor of this week's episode, Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community where you can connect with other like-minded people and creatives, and where you can explore projects that you are passionate about. This is why Skillshare is so cool, because you can unleash your creativity and you can pursue your passions right from the convenience of your own home. They offer thousands and thousands of classes for creative and curious people such as yourselves on topics like indie filmmaking, iPhone photography, editing, drone filming, classes on improving productivity, which I'll be honest, I need right now. I'm still in a little bit of a rut, so I need a little bit of a kick in the butt. So anything that can motivate me, that I'll take it. How to make videos for Instagram is another class that you can take. Things that on the intersection of art and activism, etc., etc. So if you want to explore your creativity and connect with some cool people to help motivate you, if you're in a rut like myself, get on one of those forums and maybe you can find some cool people so you can help collaborate together. Go check out Skillshare. Go to skillshare.com/smtm. That's skillshare.com/smtm, and you'll get a free trial of their premium membership. So to get a free trial of the premium membership, go to skillshare.com/smtm, or of course, there will be a link down below in the show notes. All right, now let's start peeling apart Attack the Block. So the last thing I said, I guess, at the end of First Impressions was that this was inspired by when Joe Cornish himself was mugged. So what do we think about that experience? Like, why is this film so immersive? Do you think there's something about empathy? Do you think, rather than him being on a soapbox trying to give us a film that is social commentary or that is a film about South London from the view of an outsider, like, do you think there's something about his experience that makes this film immersive, or is there just something else? Like, why is this film so successful as like an immersive trip through a foreign territory?
Well, I think there's something really beautiful that is sort of revealed by that story. Think of how many folks would go through that experience and have a really negative or reactionary response to it. And they would think of that experience as just an isolated incident, and they would, you know, make all kinds of prescriptions about that person who had tried to mug them or whatever. And to come away from that and like interrogate that experience and try to see it from the other person's eyes and recognize that, you know, nobody endangers other people or potentially endangers themselves. Well, I won't say nobody, but it's very unlikely that someone would commit petty crime without some degree of necessity or something like that. And to come away from that and create something that is like really, in some ways, you know, I don't want to get too schmaltzy about it, but it is very, very touching. And like you said, there's this movie kind of oozes empathy and understanding. And he does what what great actors always do, which is they never judge the characters that they're playing. And I think it's pretty fair to say he never judges any of the characters he's writing. But Michael, what do you got?
Well, I think it's like interesting, and this is, you know, there's like the thing we get in a lot of films is this kind of Aristotelian reversal of recognition thing, where there's a character and they think one way or they perceive the world in one way and something happens and wow, they now see it differently. Something's happened where they're on the other side of that. That's great. I think this film opens in a way that it has a similar effect on us, the viewer, because we watch the movie and we see Jodie Whittaker getting out of the tube station and we think, oh, this is a pretty woman. She's probably the main person in the movie. And Jodie Whittaker at that point had been on some TV shows in the UK, I think had more of a like star standing than many of the boys. And when we see these boys show up with masks on, one might assume she is the protagonist. She is the character we should be empathizing with. These are the boys that are bothering her. But after the attempted burglary, she runs and we stay with them. And the film kind of forces us to be with those kids. And we slowly find ourselves going from like, that's so horrible, how could they do that, to building empathy for a perspective that we maybe thought was going to be like the antagonistic force in the film. And I like what that does in disrupting expectations right off the bat. And I think it opens up the viewer to the perspective of those kids in a way they might normally not be open.
Yeah, that's a great cinematic trick just to kind of piggyback on that. It's almost like we, the audience, let's say a standard British viewing audience are Jodie Whittaker, and we're the ones who are afraid to walk through the block late at night, and we see the kids and we try to do the thing where we try to cross the street but we don't get away, and then we get mugged, and yeah, we do get her back at the police station, but not until we've already then started to be like, oh wait a second, we're gonna learn something about these kids in this extraordinary situation that they're thrown into, right? And that is really interesting. It's almost like, hey, you, the audience, you're the one taking a journey through this neighborhood, but guess what? You can't leave. You know, you can't get out so quickly and then somehow try to explain it away, or like Raymond was saying, form some sort of potential reactionary opinion on the events that happened. That is really interesting. I guess I hadn't, without trying to be like, okay, what is this film saying? What is this film saying?
is what I'm confused about, so I'm curious what everyone thinks.
Yeah, so like, do we think the film is saying something, or do you think it's more just presenting something, and then we're able to kind of be like, oh, okay, this is actually a mirror held up to us, and it makes us feel something by kind of venturing into this foreign land, and then being like, okay, well now maybe I can reformulate some opinions, which is nice because it isn't preachy, but rather it's just one holding up a mirror, maybe in the form of Jodie Whittaker, who is the character that has the big arc, right? She's the one that kind of starts. Whereas, I mean, I guess, does Boyega have an arc?
I would say Moses does as well.
Yeah.
Is it maturity? Is it learning to kind of...
Is it like acceptance of consequences? In that, and this is a thing I'm kind of curious to talk with you all about, because I worry about this interpretation in one sense, because it's a little maybe too moralistic, and interpretation coming from me, not the filmmakers. Yeah. But, you know, Boyega goes through this thing where, like, initially we see him mug someone. Then an animal at that point he thinks hurts him. And he thinks it's a dog. This dude is like, I'm going to fuck the dog up. I'm going to take my friends and we're going to fuck up this animal. Right? That's how, like, gnarly and sort of petty he is. And by the end of it, when he realizes that, you know, the alien ectoplasm on his body got his friends killed, has hurt people, that he has caused this harm, he takes that responsibility onto himself, such that, you know, if you think he might die, and he thinks he might die in protecting the people he loves and protecting his block. Now I wonder then in that, and this is what I'm kind of curious about, I hope this isn't jumping ahead, but I read a review that was from like 10 years old from The Atlantic. And the writer of that review had this take that said something like, I have this note down. He said, you know, Moses realizes it was his own reckless actions that brought the creatures and are causing those around him to suffer. The parallels to reality, where seemingly meaningless acts of crime bring more brutal law enforcement, increased poverty, are blunt but touching. So the first part of that quote from that writer, like, okay, yeah, Moses accepts responsibility for his actions. The second one, where the writer, and it's the writer Daniel D. Snyder, says, where acts of crime bring more brutal law enforcement and increased poverty, that's where I was like, ugh, because that feels like blamey. like saying like, you know, and I was wondering reading that review, I was like, was that happening in the film? Is this just a kind of reactionary writer projecting that onto it?
Well, on the one hand, the first part of that statement, I would say, having just watched the commentary, Joe Cornish even states pretty unequivocally, he said in the commentary that he doesn't think the first alien ever would have plummeted out of the sky if Moses hadn't decided to mug somebody. That to him, the movie is, in a sense, about a kind of, not necessarily karmic retribution, but there is a karmic balancing that's happening where he is learning.
So it's the opposite of save the cat. It's kill the dog.
it's kill the alien. And there is a sense that you get. He also said that he never wanted any of the other kids' deaths or endangerment to be attached to their actions. That he did, like you said, Michael. He did need to understand by the end of it that there are consequences, and maybe even in a broader sense that like doing the right thing is not always easy, but it's always going to be right. And you know, it's worth it to do the decent thing. I think the second part of that statement may be a little bit problematic, but I mean, I think in a perfect world, we could read that the second part of that statement exclusively in bad faith, where he's saying, oh, it always brings, you know, law enforcement. We live in a very imperfect world where, like, the truth of the matter is whether or not it should bring more law enforcement. You know, I personally believe that it shouldn't. That is quite commonly that is the response to crime is further militarization and funding of the police.
So you're saying like there's a way just you're kind of opting for, which I think this is good, or a realist take where a take like that isn't to project it onto
I haven't read the rest of that review. Maybe the next sentence he says, and that's the way it should be, and I'll have to eat some crow. But
he's the president of the police union in Pittsburgh, so I don't know if that changes anything.
No. A little movie film criticism op-ed.
What do you think about the sort of moral and aspects of the characters' journeys here, Austin?
I mean, I feel like it's kind of part and parcel of any sort of Western hero tale, right? Is there's always some sort of lesson that is learned, and even when it's done cleverly, there's always some sort of moral tale that is told. I think it's kind of woven into the fabric of how we tell story. And if there is the moment where, like, if you read, like, I don't know, John Truby's Anatomy of Story, and he has the seven essential kind of, like, points that you have to hit, the final two for him are, like, the final battle, which you obviously get with Moses and the aliens. And it's a great final, like, that's a great, like, but before the final battle even happens, there's a moment of realization. And the moment of realization, I wondered, as you were talking, Michael, is it's almost like not self-sacrifice. There's two ways that you could look at it. One is it's like, I'm going to be the fucking hero, which they do talk about like fame a bit, you know, wanting notoriety, you know, somehow getting out of the block, maybe, even if it's just in their own imagination. And so maybe he's fantasizing with that, but I don't think so. I do think it's much more grounded. I do think it's shit, you know, a couple of my friends are dead because of me. And there is a sense in which he's taking responsibility. And once you start talking about like responsabilization, which is a term that academics like to use now, you're already in moralistic territory, right? And so he is taking responsibility, and it is a sort of like moral maturity in that, to recognize that. And I think that then what he does is he almost does like a Jesus thing where he's like, well, then I'm just going to sacrifice myself. And I think he kind of does accept his fate, so to speak, which again is kind of like a tragic acceptance, right? So there's some classic storytelling points that I think are really being covered here with the hero myth, with the acceptance of responsibility, with a moral tale, and then with a sort of tragic focus. And then what I wonder is at the end, for John Truby, again, to kind of like go back to that reference that I mentioned, who wrote this book, Anatomy of Story, he's a famous script doctor. The whole idea is that now the protagonist can never go back to the world that it once knew before because it's learned. You know, it's confronted his or her own moral failings and then the social failings of society. The world is now changed, and he or she, in this instance, he is now changed and he can never go back. So that's what I wonder is there some sort of change, or is it really more just that the world has changed? Like, has he changed in the sense that he's matured and he realizes, okay, I can't engage in petty crime anymore and I can't do that? Like somehow is he like mad at himself for his previous hoodlum ways and he's like judging himself? I don't know that that's the case, because I don't think that this film is taking a stance on this is why you shouldn't be involved in petty crime if you are on the lower socioeconomic spectrum, right? So I don't think it's that. It's something else, and yeah. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but there's something that he's learned, but it's not like...
Yeah.
It's not like we don't judge who he was at the beginning of the film so much.
Well, I think there's a way in which like parts of who he was at the beginning of the film that we didn't see are revealed. I think there's this scene when they're in the weed room, and I don't know if it's Moses or one of the other guys that says to the Jodie Whittaker character, Samantha, they say to her, like, if we would have known you lived here, we never would have done that. Yeah. And you see that they have this
there's like a civic pride code. In a way. Yeah.
It's like, oh, like we assumed you were from outside of here. We assumed you weren't like one of us. And it was interesting to see that there is that little bit of a code, and maybe it's like an extending of that that's happening. But I did think it was interesting that it slowly reveals like they already had this kind of code. Maybe it's about them extending that further or seeing people from outside the block as having the personhood of those from within the block.
Yeah, because remember, they're disappointed when they mug her, too. And they're like, oh, she's a nurse. She's got nothing on her. Well, you know, why are you mugging a nurse? You know, they don't make any money. And it's just a real offhanded remark as they're walking away. But yeah, and then they find out that she's not even a nurse. She's a trainee. She, like, just graduated. So, it is interesting that there is a code about how they're all in this together kind of thing. You know, what were you going to say, Raymond?
Oh, I was just going to say, apropos of what Michael was saying about the like attachment to this place more than anything as like its own type of character, it just kind of reminded me of I don't know if y'all have seen the documentary about Cory Booker from like a decade ago. I think it's called Street Fight. And there's a scene in which he's holding kind of like a town hall at the apartment, the apartment block or wherever he lives. And all these people who have the opportunity to go and like ask him questions about policy and, you know, his platform and everything, all they want to know is like, do you actually live here? Mm-hmm. And he keeps saying like, you can go to my apartment, you can go into my house right now and see dirty dishes in the sink and blah, blah, blah. But it is one of those things that it weirdly does kind of come to the foreground in this movie, a movie that I think is in a certain way, very, very much about class and how, the gang of kids are perceived to be a certain class by how they present at the very beginning of the movie. Samantha, in much the same way, is perceived to be of a certain class that she not necessarily is, because she's a nurse. Oh, she's just a nurse trainee. Oh, she lives here. Like, she's one of us. And there is this kind of subtle commentary about the distinction of class and how that creates a certain unity or solidarity.
Let's get deep into potentially one of the themes relating to class, race, social exclusion, etc. Here's a quote from Moses. It's probably like the quote that is the most heavy-handed quote in the film. He's sitting in the apartment after the chaos. This is in the middle of the madness. And he says, "Government probably bred those things to kill black boys. First they sent in drugs. Then they sent guns, and now they're sending in monsters to kill us. They don't care, man. We ain't killing each other fast enough, so they decided to speed up the process." Do you think that these aliens are a metaphor? Do you think that this is just, again, when I first watched it, I was like, oh, this is just his perspective, which is so lovely, because again, it isn't like government officials are saying, we don't know where these aliens come from. We don't understand their intention. And this is how it is. Remember when Kyrie Irving said that the earth was flat and everyone was, or he said that he didn't know and everyone kind of freaked out. And then in the interview later, he's like, look, man, he's like, I'm from a neighborhood where we just don't trust authority figures just because they say something. I've been misled too many times, right? By people to just say, this is how things are. This is how things are. Why am I just supposed to trust the people? He's like, I don't know. He's like it could be, and I thought that was actually a really kind of poignant remark, and I feel like this is something similar. This is kind of him saying, look, man, from my perspective, this is how things are. They've tried all this shit constantly. In my experience, this is probably the feds, as they keep saying, just throwing something into our neighborhood to kill us faster because we're not doing it fast enough. So what do we think about this quote? What does it mean? What's it saying? Et cetera.
It kind of reminds me of, I think it was a Clickhole blurb that said something like, QAnon is a conspiracy theory that holds that powerful elites are secretly evil instead of outwardly and openly evil. And it does kind of dovetail nicely with that, this notion that, like, well, yeah, I mean, what is the apply Occam's razor to this thing, and what is more likely, that our first interaction, our first known interaction with an alien life form would just hurtle out of the sky and land on our block, or that, you know, marginalized communities would continue to be oppressed and purposefully marginalized by a relentless and uncaring government. Michael, I know that you are the resident NBA enthusiast. I wonder if you have anything to say about the... I remember Kyrie kind of recanting as well, saying that he was like, look, I just went down a really bad YouTube wormhole. Yeah. I think he notched it up to experience in the end, but what do you got, Michael?
Well, we were going to introduce a new segment called the NBA Playoff Moment, so everyone grab your... No, I'm kidding. but I don't leave. I mean, yeah, I think that the Kyrie example, I think, interesting in that way, because he later was just kind of like, I don't know, like, I saw some stuff, I was just asking some questions, I don't know. Like, there's something about it that, if we're really, really generous, is like the Socratic, like, know what you don't know. And Kyrie was just sort of like, listen, I don't know that. Like, I haven't been in space. I don't have this sort of knowledge. I'm not just going to assume things. So, you know, that's kind of fun. But on the example and that great quote, I'm so glad you brought that one up, Austin. I feel like there's like these two perspectives of that, right? So you have Moses, who's like, of course this shit is happening. Of course, after everything we deal with in this community, life gets even harder for us with fucking aliens from the sky with blue teeth and you know, non-reflective black fur or whatever. On the flip side, it's just another example of something that the police officers or whoever arresting them will never believe and will never understand. And it makes me think of, like, there's some points, I forget which season, there's a few parts in, like, The Wire where what makes the show so brutal is you see how horrifically hard, like, especially I think season 2 or season 3 with the kids, you see how hard their lives are, and then how from the perspective of, like, a cop or a teacher sometimes, it's like, well, work harder. Well, you know, you got to do this different. But it's like, no, you don't get it. And there's that final scene, of course, where, like, he's getting arrested. All the aliens are dead, so there's no, like, evidence, really. No one's going to believe any of these people. And that's why I brought this up before. It reminds me of the alternate ending of Get Out, which is one of the most fucked up things ever.
It's gut-churning, yeah.
Yeah, so we all know in Get Out, at the end, Lil Rel shows up, saves the day. The TSA doesn't mess around. I think Chris, the protagonist, gets away okay. One of the original endings, which they changed, he gets arrested and goes to jail. And no one believes him, because why would anything that the protagonist of Get Out, why would a story ever be true? Yeah, well, someone was going to take your brain and put it in someone else's head? Okay. And in the same way, you're left in this film, and you were talking about, like, you know, the ending of it, Austin, that's sort of like the tragic element. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. Probably not good. I guess we'll find out in this new version. But I do think there is a realism there, and that reminder that no matter how hard it is for Moses and his friends, most people in authority are never going to see that. And then, of course, in the Samantha character, we see someone that has that journey from beginning of the film, y'all are fucking monsters. By the end, she's sticking up for him, you know, with authority figures.
It is kind of perfect that it's 10 years later, because I wonder if he's been in juvenile, because he's 15 years old. So now if he's mid-20s, and maybe he's been in juvenile, I don't know what the plot is, but maybe he's
been
in juvenile.
The movie could pick up, like, post-incarceration.
That's right.
You could go 1,000 different... I'm really excited for it.
Because if the cops do hold him responsible, and obviously this is total speculation for people listening, but if the cops do... if he is arrested, he wouldn't be tried as an adult. He's 15 years old. Is 16, because I know 16 is the age of consent in the UK, is 16 when they would, is that like legal? If you're British, let us know. Is that when in the comments?
If you're a British teenager who commits crimes, let us know what happens.
When do you freak out? For me, when we were committing petty crimes, 18 was the age when I was like, oh, yeah. No longer can we go do stupid shit. But if, for you, if it's 16, let us know.
even if he is, you know, tried as an adult, who knows? Is the sentence for blowing up an apartment 10 years? Like, what is the... Is it disturbing of the peace? Will they make some joke about how it's just a slap on the wrist despite being, like, immensely devastating? No, I think that kind of what y'all were talking about before about how no one is going to believe this kid, it does come back to this thing just to sort of like sidetrack to an aesthetic kind of conversation really quickly. I think there are a lot of movies, especially in recent years, especially in genre, where the 80s thing has been so done to death and everyone is trying to, like, whether it's, you know, the John Carpenter fonts for their title cards or the synth heavy scores or just straight up 80s nostalgia with all the fetishization of the wardrobes and stuff like that. And none of those movies or TV shows do the 80s vibe as well as this movie does with it, for example, law enforcement being this sort of false friend, the way that, like, when the FBI shows up in Die Hard, they immediately make things much worse. There is this really cool vibe with all of this that you don't see much in movies anymore. It has, like, the sort of Gremlins tone and the John Carpenter tone of being a movie that, Michael, you said before we got on air that because you don't do spooky things very well, but you can handle kind of jump scary things here and there. This is a great movie to introduce, not necessarily kids, but it's I think a great genre sort of bridge piece that can help bring, you know, younger folks into the conventions or the vernacular of science fiction and horror, and we just don't get a lot of those anymore, so I think it's really special. But sorry, that's my Raymond's aesthetic corner really quick.
No, this is great, because I do want to talk about the aesthetic too, because this film, like I said when I was giving my first impressions and talking about revisiting it, this film to me is more, and I just don't have the vocabulary to say it better, but it's more vibey, it's more Tony than I was expecting it to be, than anything, you know? It's not style to the neglect of substance or form to the neglect of content. It's actually its form in the service of content and vice versa, right? Like, there's this wonderful kind of dual relation that it holds, and it's the speed. It's got a very Edgar Wright kind of feel to it, how there's just there's no fat on this at all. What is it, an hour and a half? And it moves
88 like minutes. Yeah.
Like that, if you can, that's a gift to cinema goers, right? Is like, here, just have this really tightly packed, you get in, immediately the aliens are there within the first 5 minutes. Like, there isn't like a world that's set up. Like, the way that they set up the world is a dark street and a woman walking at night and some teens with masks. And that's the world. And you're like, oh, okay, I know where we are. Yeah. Like I get it.
Yeah, there's
okay.
Like a quick overhead shot of London for like 30 seconds. You're like, cool, let's go.
Yeah.
And I do think the soundtrack helps a lot. I think it's Basement Jaxx did all the music for it. And it keeps you going the whole time. You know, you talked about Raymond like doing the director's cut without the music. It has to be interesting to see that without that sort of like...
Yeah, without the dialogue.
Without dialogue. Sorry. Yeah. But I was really impressed by how much work the soundtrack does. And another thing that Edgar Wright is very good at doing.
Absolutely. Yeah, a phenomenal visual storyteller, Edgar Wright. I think he's up there with any contemporary filmmaker.
Yeah, what was his role?
He was in one of the executive producers, and he also knew Joe Cornish for a decade before he made this. And in Joe Cornish's own words, he said that Edgar Wright not only is a close friend, but something of a mentor to him. And
okay,
they, funny enough, Edgar Wright, while working in a producer capacity on this, really just kind of helped get the ball rolling on the project, because he was at the time finishing up Scott Pilgrim versus the World, to the point where the two of them had these movies in like neighboring editing suites when they were putting the final touches on them. So they would kind of like work on their movie, then they'd go next door and give each other notes on this, that, and the other. And I do think it is, they say it several times in the commentary, that 88 minutes, Edgar Wright at one point, he says, it's just with no like elucidation whatsoever, he goes, 88 minutes is just the perfect runtime for a first feature. And Joe Cornish just goes, yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Never thought about this before too. Isn't it the case that Edgar Wright was supposed to either write or direct the first Ant-Man film, and then Cornish took over?
No. Peyton Reed eventually directed that film.
Has Cornish worked on a Marvel movie or is about to? Am I making this up?
I don't know that he has. I know that he's been... I should know this. This is literally my job on this podcast, is to know stuff like this. The Ant-Man saga is sort of a tale of woes. I know that Edgar Wright was working on Ant-Man before the MCU was even a thing. Like, he had been pushing that boulder uphill forever because that character means so much to him. And within just a few weeks that he was supposed to go into production on this script he had been developing for like a decade, they came in with a
draft of the screenplay.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, he probably co-wrote Edgar Wright's with draft Edgar. Of it.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I knew he had something to do with it. Sorry for distracting us. No, it's all good. Everyone.
Did they, in the commentary, did they talk about some of the the specific choices with regards to why the aliens looked the way they did?
Absolutely.
Can we talk about that a little bit? Because that was a really cool... Yeah. I love these fucking alien
I love that, like, Vanta black surface and, like, the only three-dimensional thing on them is the teeth. It's so cool. But he said that it was largely inspired by Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings adaptation, which, if you're familiar, is an animated adaptation from the 70s. I think it was 79. And the ring wraiths in that are similar, that they would film a live action reference and then they would animate over that. And just the way that the ring wraiths are kind of flattened into this really sort of like hyper absorbent 2D sort of silhouettes, no matter what kind of light they were in and stuff. He just really liked that notion. And they talked a lot about, on the special features, they talked a lot about how they achieved that in this movie.
How did they achieve that in this movie?
Well, I mean, through rotoscoping, the same way that Ralph Bakshi achieved it in the 70s. Cool. And that's one of the really, really cool things about this. On the very first episode of this show that I ever appeared on, I went on a tangent about how great Total Recall's practical effects are. And they are. And this movie is kind of in, I don't necessarily know, a similar vein, because its effects are being done and deployed in a very different way. But this is just a reminder of how effective simple tricks are, that they had a guy in this sort of like gorilla suit who was chasing these kids around. And then in post, they essentially just like, they just went in and colored over him with just a flat black, you know? And what was so cool is they said in a lot of the shots, they talk about how they wanted the housing block to essentially be the Nostromo from Alien, where they're in the like very foggy hallways and they're kind of like downlit from those lights above, or those windows above the doors. And there are some sequences where the aliens are kind of coming around corners and you see them backlit through the fog, like something straight out of Alien. And he said he was so surprised. There were tons of shots like that where they thought, well, we're going to have to, you know, do a pass on this in post and touch up the effects and stuff. And he said there were a lot of times when the light just caught it perfectly and they didn't have to retouch it at all. And just, yeah, it just speaks to the power of what you can do when there is not only a plan for implementing these effects on the back end in, you know, in the good old fashioned practical sense, but also having something there for the actors to respond to, react to in you know, live in front of the cameras. You really can't replace it. You know, no amount of tennis balls can bring that same effect out of the performers surrounding it.
Yeah, let's
Real,
talk
like,
a little
creativity
bit.
Through constraints thing here. Sorry, Austin. I was just
no. Yeah, no. That's so much. Keep going.
Oh, no, it's just simply saying that it's a real example of like awesome creativity being inspired by constraints, low budget, and them just doing incredible things with it. Cliche thing to point out, but hearing that is just making me like this movie even more than I already did.
Let's talk a little bit about the performances and the actors. As we said at the outset of the episode, most of these are, you know, just non-professional local teens that they brought on board. I think John Boyega was an actor, right? But the rest of the cast were not. Is that correct? Or was even he a first-timer?
I think I read it was a lot of kids from like community theater programs in London. So they were like just truly kids from neighborhoods like that, and they were in like youth theater.
Yeah. They said pretty much every kid that was interviewed on the special features said that they had an acting teacher or an acting coach or at least a director that had brought them this casting notice, because they just did an open call for a lot of these roles. I think they said they read upwards of 1,700 or 1,800 kids.
Wow. I personally really love the two young ones too that are like what what, like,
so funny,
9 and 6 or whatever. And it's so cute because you have like these age differences. You've got Jody, who's what, early 20s, and then you've got the teens who are just barely teenager, let's say 13 to 15, and then you've got these other kids. And so you get Boyega's kind of maturity. He wants to be older than he looks. He's like very proud of that fact. But then you're also like, but you're just a fucking kid. But then, of course, they're constantly talking to the kids and they're like, no, you guys are just kids. Like, you're too young. And then those kids, they want to be old because they want to be cool like the rest, the other kids in the gang.
Well, and then so there's like the gang leader, weird rapper, Weed Kingpin guy.
Hi-Hat,
who treats, you know, Boyega and the guys like just
and what is he,
idiots.
Mid? He's like mid-20s probably or something like that.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
But it is interesting how like the sort of like the wake trail of influence sort
of exactly
back through the, you know, the age ranges that like these kids do like look up to other kids. It's like the John Mulaney bit about hiring a horse to watch a dog or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really kind of well done how you're kind of given, and it's never even really commented on, but you're kind of given a shot into like three generations that are kind of like all living within this place.
And you
but
can
what do you
see
think
how like some of the more unsavory aspects of what some of these kids get involved in become like cyclical and self-sustaining.
Exactly.
It is, exactly. I think, a pretty I would say subtle but conscious critique of a lot of like systemic class issues.
It's almost like a faded deterministic logic that, oh, these young 6-year-olds are going to be like Hi-Hats, right? Eventually they're going to become the teenage gangsters, and then they're going to go, and then they're going to end up like that's where they're going to go,
unless their intermediary influence being Moses finds a way to divert from that path, you know,
to sort of part a Red Sea of bad influence and take them to a land of milk, honey, and I don't know, like uni funding or something.
I was gonna say fireworks.
Oh yeah, fireworks. Sorry.
Okay, so last thing, let's do this. This is a very simple question, but like, why does this film work so well? We've all spoken quite highly about this film, and we've talked about the aesthetic, the energy, the kind of interesting social commentary. If we could encapsulate it in just a soundbite, like, why does this film work?
I'll say something really simple and let you guys say smart stuff. This movie builds a clear and specific world upon which it lays a very simple and executable premise,
which is great, I think, because we have so many people who write to us that are like aspiring filmmakers too. And I love what you said that Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish in the commentary said 88 minutes is the perfect length for a first feature. Because I've been to so many film festivals, and you get these young people, I'm gonna say young dudes in particular, who have these like 3-hour epics that are inspired by Malick and inspired by Tarkovsky,
cramming every idea and influence they've ever had.
Yeah, and I get it, and I get it. Like I'm loquacious, so just imagine if I was making a feature, it would be a 5-hour fucking, it would be a Bellatar film. So I get it, but there is something lovely about being able to just tighten something up in this really neat package that you can give to people.
Yeah. I also think there is, Michael basically took my answer. I think he keeps it simple.
Oh, no.
And that's no. I mean, I think that's a testament to the value of simplicity a lot of the times, especially in such a plot driven or genre specific script. But I would also say on top of that is that I kind of touched on this before, that he never judges the characters he's writing. Not only that, but he really entrenched himself in a lot of these communities, and like would just hang around kids and like listen to the way that they talked. And it reminds me of early Spielberg in a way. Like, you know, some of the great stuff about like E.T. is that the camera's always on the level of the children. The camera literally never looks down on the children in that movie. And I think there's something to that he, you know, he put in the effort, and it comes back to that old adage of like, there's nothing more universal than the specific, you know, if you can really illuminate the inner lives of people, you can't help but be kind of engrossing. And I think this script Yeah, the script is so simple, but also so deeply empathetic. It's just great work.
That's a perfect way to kind of wrap up the discussion of Attack the Block. Yeah, so definitely check out this film. It's fantastic. It's fun. It's energetic. And it'll make you think a little, too, which is always, I think, a plus when you're talking about a film.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So now let's jump into the mailbag. We got an onslaught of voicemails and emails all wanting to talk about the Bo Burnham Inside episode. So if you want to continue to contribute to conversations about Inside, you can keep emailing us and calling us about that. Or if you want to talk about Attack the Block or anything else in our back catalog, you can drop us a voicemail at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. So I didn't get a name on this voicemail, so we'll just say it's anonymous unless they say it and I just didn't pick up on it, but has some thoughts about Inside. So let's go ahead and roll that first voicemail.
All right, guys. So I'm doing dishes, but hearing out on Inside. So I think Inside's a very interesting piece, and I think the reason y'all were talking about it during the podcast and you were trying to figure out why exactly it was so big, y'all explored the option that it might just be Zoomer mentality of, like, baby's first philosophy class, basically. But I think that's a misunderstanding of why it's so big. Bo Burnham has always been, like, a leader in the public space for having, like, critical thought in his comedy. And the fact of the matter is that when he produces content, it is always to the highest quality. You can see it in all his acts from, I believe, his second special. He had full sections of recorded audio that would play only at specific times, set up where he would set up the lights, do everything. So the entire show is intentional. From beginning to end, every light, every prop, I have no doubt that it is all set up with intention.
I don't know. You guys were steering the ship last week. I couldn't attend. So what do you think?
Well, it makes me think of, I went and rewatched his earlier specials after talking about Inside. And for anyone who was mad at me because they thought like I didn't like it enough, I think I like it more now. So get less mad at me, please. But there's a bit, I think it's in Make Happy, where he knocks a water bottle over and acts like it's an accident, and then immediately a song plays about how that was all intentional and you fell for it.
And life is a lie. Yeah.
Yeah. And he does that. And there's a thing in both of the specials, both in Make Happy and in What, where early on he does something, reveals that you thought it was a trick and it was intentional, and that, yeah, nothing's real. So I think, like, I kind of looked back at Inside then with those moments as kind of like the Rosetta Stone for interpreting stuff, and it really made me think of it differently, of how intentional, how specific he is, how everything's a choice.
And I think there is a large degree to which I think so many folks have been putting the sort of restrictions of this special first in their discussion of it. Like, they've taken that context and made it into the content, and I don't necessarily think that's fair, because that implies that it was sort of unplanned or spur of the moment. You know, obviously it wasn't planned in the sense that he had been working on this for like 2 or 3 years and then just waiting for a pandemic to strike or whatever. But I do think that he was, you know, wrestling with some big ideas. Maybe he doesn't always hit the mark right on the nose. But there is definitely some authorial intent behind it. You know, when, for example, there's that moment I had mentioned in our conversation before, Michael, where he's sort of lying on the ground and just free associating about the perils of social media. And that's kind of what it comes off as. But then you realize, like, oh, the camera is suspended above him in a pretty tricky composition, and he has a very balanced frame with like a set of headphones right here and a mixer right here. It's like, it's pretty good composition. Like, you can spiral a golden ratio right off of his nose. And it frame. You know, there is that aspect of it that if you engage with the work as an intentional piece of art where everything that is inside the frame and outside the frame is either there or not for a reason, I think it would open the discussion up a little bit more to the intent rather than just like, oh, the primal scream of it all. You know, I for one think it is something of a natural progression of his onstage persona, at least given the circumstances.
Yeah, and I wonder what it says about us that we rush so quickly oftentimes to look for that, to try to find the distinction between, oh, is this real, is this authentic, or was this staged? What are we looking for in that question? That's what I'm more interested in. And does that somehow invalidate what he's saying? Like, if I rehearse the thoughts in my head, but yet I just set up a camera and I'm like, well, I'm just going to record what comes out at a given moment, is it somehow more authentic because I didn't say, okay, I'm going to sit down in this moment and record it with this screen composition? And maybe in post, he adjusts the frame to make it so that it has that golden ratio aspect that you're talking about, right? So like, is that more authentic? Or maybe if I'm just sitting there stream of consciousness and I'm writing, why is that more supposedly primal in my expression? And why is that something that people would gravitate to? Not that it shouldn't be. I'm not asking that as a rhetorical question. I'm asking that seriously. Like, what is it that elicits that kind of response? And I wonder if there's something that people are searching for and they look for, like, a voice of authenticity. And then when they feel like it's manicured for them, it just feels like spin, like political spin or social spin. And because we're so jaded and spurned by the manicured media stories that we're fed all the time, that we want somebody to just fucking break out of that and be like, no, you know, like this is it. And then so I think if people are expecting that, especially in a commentary that is critiquing that kind of fabricated and manicured media landscape, then we are like, no, but therefore it can't be rehearsed, right? Like, it has to be real. And I'm like, but what if I sit here in my room late at night and I rehearse thoughts 1,000 times in my head, which I've done, about what to think about a particular social situation or a social artifact? Like, am I not rehearsing? Am I not staging?
Well, and I think that's something that Burnham's really getting at, right, with, like, the social media stuff. And I think he says this in his special What, that, like, people in the audience view him as a performer, but he's like, we are all performing via social media constantly. And the same moment you're referring to, Raymond, where he kind of says, like, you know, should we exploit the neurochemical drama of kids so Silicon Valley companies can make money? Like, everything is tied into this logic of performance and authenticity. And at times it's like performing authenticity is what gets people, you know, the biggest amount of, like, clout or attention. And we don't know anymore. And I think because we don't know, we want to hold on to something real. And I think if we think something real, if we think it's real and we find out it might not be, it, like, hurts people's feelings. They feel fooled. And I think there's some people whose reaction to Inside is sort of like, I think they dislike it because they felt so close to feeling something, but then they thought, like, who are you to do this to me, Bo Burnham? Who are you to perform this sort of thing? Which then gets back to your point, Austin. Like, does that mean it's not authentic? Does that mean he doesn't really think those things? Does it mean that he hasn't really felt those things? Like, if he cries and it's fake on camera, does that negate the fact that maybe that morning he was also crying? I don't know. I don't know the answers to this. But
that draws into question the authenticity of any art. I mean, and that's a huge conversation. Like, if
so, let's get into that. Now.
The second hour of our program begins now. You know, but I think there is a degree to which some folks, when they watch a movie and they get swept up in a moment and they cry along with the characters, like, people deep down in their heart, they know that, you know, Natalie Portman isn't really, like, she's affecting an emotional facsimile, like, for their own catharsis. And it, you know, it's like, that's literally any art. And I love that he does not feel, at the risk of sounding kind of punny, he doesn't feel confined by the expectations of the comedy special as a genre or as a format, that he can have those more confessional moments or more authentic moments that you take a step back from and say, okay, but is this Bo Burnham or is this Bo Burnham in scare quotes? You know, like, it there is a lot of a lot to chew on, I think.
So Michael and I, Michael and I used to teach at the same university when we were in grad school together. And do you remember the essay by by Borges called Borges and I that we assigned to? It was the metaphysics class, like Descartes Thought and Reality class.
Yeah. So I don't remember it.
There's this amazing, just speaking on this, there's this amazing little essay by Jorge Luis Borges called Borges and I. And I would just, it's like half a page. So I would recommend, if you're listening, it's B-O-R-G-E-S. Yeah, it's B-O-R-G-E-S, Borges and I. And he talks about this, how there's a distinction between I and the Borges. And he's like, the Borges is receiving mail. The Borges is doing these things. And then I continue to give myself over to Borges. And he's like, I don't know if it's me or Borges. And there's this really lovely kind of back and forth, this relationship between kind of like the abstract entity that you were just saying. Is it Bo Burnham in scare quotes? Or is it Bo Burnham the I? And there's this really, yeah, it's a really kind of, I think, difficult and kind of fraught terrain that artists and whatnot have always sort of explored. So definitely check that out if people are listening. Okay, we have to wrap up the episode there. We'll get into more of the inside stuff, I'm sure, next week with the mailbag, because we did. We got about almost 10 or so emails all asking similar questions around the special. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in the
mailbag
segment.
Unless the attack the block stands, just melt the phones, man. just melt down that switchboard.
Which is fine, which is more than fine.
Movies at Wisecrack, tell us all about it.
That's right. Go ahead. Here, plug the email, because I didn't plug the email, Michael, just so people know.
I was being a company man. I noticed it where you did, and I was like, gotta be a company man. Gotta give them an email. Movies at wisecrack.co, everyone. If any of the higher-ups are watching, movies at wisecrack.co. But you really nailed the phone number, though. That was awesome.
Let's get out of here. Where can people find you on the internet, Michael?
Michael O. Burns on most social media stuff. Come say hi.
And Raymond?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria. And since I didn't get to do last week's episode about Inside with these wonderful gentlemen, I wrote a slightly more extensive review of it on my Letterboxd in case anyone was interested.
And if you want, you can check me out on Twitter, Austin_Hayden, Insta, AUS_HAY. I forget, I got to plug my TikTok too. I got a TikTok. It's Austin.Hayden. I talk about like philosophy and religion and Christianity. I've had a couple videos that have kind of popped pretty hard about my experience as a post-evangelical that a lot of people found that resonated with them. So check that out if you're kind of struggling in the post-Christian world and you're looking for voices. There's actually a really good kind of deconstruction aspect of TikTok. A lot of good voices out there giving people kind of like queer pastors and a lot of like critical race theory scholars and things like that that are looking at Christianity from through a critical lens. So if that's your vibe, if you need some support, if you're dealing with like a post-Christian landscape thing, come find me, and then I can kind of like direct you to other people on TikTok too that are kind of sharing their experiences. Aftermath.
You could be their Moses. You could be their Moses of sorts.
I want to just be their heretical Jesus. The heretical Jesus. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, send us out of here, Raymond.
Oh, goodbye from a housing block in South London. It's Show Me the Moses.